I have no idea why, but after she reviewed and endorsed NASA's data earlier this afternoon, she has suddenly pulled an about-face and is spouting some of the most improbable allegations imaginable of NASA treachery and fraud.
Pickering sounded intense now.
Excuse me?
Troubling, yes. I hate to be the one to tell you this, but Miss Sexton contacted me 2 minutes before the press conference and warned me to cancel the whole thing.
On what grounds?
Absurd ones, frankly. She said she'd found serious flaws in the data.
Pickering's long silence was more wary than Tench would have liked.
Flaws?
He finally said.
Ridiculous, really. After 2 full weeks of NASA experimentation and...
I find it very hard to believe someone like Rachel Sexton would have told you to postpone the president's press conference unless she had a damn good reason. Pickering sounded troubled.
Maybe you should have listened to her.
Oh, please.
Tench blurted, coughing.
You saw the press conference. The meteorite data was confirmed and reconfirmed by countless specialists, including civilians. Doesn't it seem suspicious to you that Rachel Sexton, the daughter of the only man whom this announcement hurts, is suddenly changing her tune?
It seems suspicious, Miss Tench, only because I happen to know that Miss Sexton and her father are barely civil to one another. I cannot imagine why Rachel Sexton would, after years of service to the president, suddenly decide to switch camps and tell lies to support her father.
Ambition, perhaps? I really don't know. Maybe the opportunity to be first daughter.
Tench let it hang. Pickering's tone hardened instantly.
Thin ice, Miss Tench. Very thin.
Tench scowled. What the hell did she expect? She was accusing a prominent member of Pickering's staff of treason against the president. The man was going to be defensive.
Put her on, Pickering demanded. I'd like to speak to Miss Sexton myself.
I'm afraid that's impossible,
Tench replied.
She's not at the White House.
Where is she?
The president sent her to Milne this morning to examine the data firsthand. She has yet to return.
Pickering sounded livid now.
I was never informed. I do not have time for hurt pride, Director. I have simply called as a courtesy.
I wanted to warn you that Rachel Sexton has decided to pursue her own agenda with respect to tonight's announcement. She will be looking for allies. If she contacts you, you would be wise to know that the White House is in possession of a video taken earlier today in which she endorsed this meteorite data in its entirety in front of the president, his cabinet, and his entire staff. If now, for whatever motive she might have, Rachel Sexton attempts to besmirch the good name of Zach Herney or of NASA, then I swear to you the White House will see to it she falls hard and far.
Tench waited a moment to be sure her meaning had settled in.
I expect you to repay the courtesy of this call by informing me immediately if Rachel Sexton contacts you. She is attacking the president directly, and the White House intends to detain her for questioning before she does any serious damage. I will be waiting for your call, Director. That's all. Good night.
Marjorie Tench hung up, certain that William Pickering had never been talked to like that in his life. At least now, he knew she was serious. On the top floor of the NRO, William Pickering stood at his window and stared into the Virginia night. The call from Marjorie Tench had been deeply troubling. He chewed at his lip as he tried to assemble the pieces in his mind.
"Director?"
his secretary said, knocking quietly.
"You have another phone call."
"Not now,"
Pickering said absently.
"It's Rachel Sexton."
Pickering wheeled. Tench was apparently a fortune teller.
"Okay, patch her through right away."
"Actually, sir, it's an encrypted AV stream. Do you want to take it in the conference room?"
"An AV stream?
Where is she calling from?"
The secretary told him. Pickering stared. Bewildered, he hurried down the hall toward the conference room. This was something he had to see. Chapter 70.
The Charlotte's dead room, designed after a similar structure at Bell Laboratories, was what was formerly known as an anechoic chamber, an acoustical clean room. Containing no parallel or reflective surfaces, it absorbed sound with 99.4% efficiency. Because of the acoustically conductive nature of metal and water, conversations on board submarines were always vulnerable to interception by nearby eavesdroppers or parasitic suction mics attached to the outer hull. The dead room was, in effect, a tiny chamber inside the submarine from which absolutely no sound could escape. All conversations inside this insulated box were entirely secure. The chamber looked like a walk-in closet, whose ceiling, walls, and floor had been completely covered with foam spires, jutting inward from all directions. It reminded Rachel of a cramped underwater cave where stalagmites had run wild, growing off every surface. Most unsettling, however, was the apparent lack of a floor. The floor was a taut, meshed, chicken-wire grid strung horizontally across the room like a fishing net, giving the inhabitants the feeling that they were suspended midway up the wall. The mesh was rubberized and stiff beneath the feet. As Rachel gazed down through the webbed flooring, she felt like she was crossing a string bridge suspended over a surrealistic, fractalized landscape. 3 feet below, a forest of foam needles pointed ominously upward. Instantly upon entering, Rachel had sensed the disorienting lifelessness to the air, as if every bit of energy had been sucked out. Her ears felt as if they'd been stuffed with cotton. Only her breath was audible inside her head. She called out, and the effect was that of speaking into a pillow. The walls absorbed every reverberation, making the only perceivable vibrations those inside her head. Now the captain had departed, closing the padded door behind him. Rachel, Corky, and Tolland were seated in the center of the room at a small U-shaped table that stood on long metal stilts that descended through the mesh. On the table were affixed several gooseneck microphones, headphones, and a video console with a fisheye camera on top. It looked like a mini United Nations symposium. As someone who worked in the U.S. intelligence community, the world's foremost manufacturers of hard laser microphones, underwater parabolic eavesdroppers, and other hypersensitive listening devices, Rachel was well aware there were few places on Earth where one could have a truly secure conversation. The dead room was, apparently, one of those places. The mics and headphones on the table enabled a face-to-face conference call in which people could speak freely, knowing the vibrations of their words could not escape the room. Their voices, upon entering the microphones, would be heavily encrypted for their long journey through the atmosphere.
Level check.
The voice materialized suddenly inside their headphones, causing Rachel, Tolland, and Corky to jump.
Do you read me, Miss Sexton?
Rachel leaned into her microphone.
Yes, thank you.
Whoever you are.
I have Director Pickering on the line for you. He's accepting AV. I am signing off now. You will have your data stream momentarily. Rachel heard the line go dead. Then there was a distant whir of static, and then a rapid series of beeps and clicks in the headphones. With startling clarity, the video screen in front of them sprang to life, and Rachel saw Director Pickering in the NRO conference room. He was alone. His head snapped up, and he looked into Rachel's eyes. She felt oddly relieved to see him.
"Miss Sexton," he said, his expression perplexed and troubled. "What in the world is going on?"
"The meteorite, sir," Rachel said. "I think we may have a serious problem."
Chapter 71. Inside the Charlotte's dead room, Rachel Sexton introduced Michael Tolland and Corky Marlinson to Pickering. Then she took charge and launched into a quick account of the day's incredible chain of events. The NRO director sat motionless as he listened. Rachel told him about the bioluminescent plankton in the extraction pit, their journey onto the ice shelf, and discovery of an insertion shaft beneath the meteorite, and finally of their sudden attack by a military team she suspected was special ops.
William Pickering was known for his ability to listen to disturbing information without so much as flinching an eye, and yet his gaze grew more and more troubled with each progression in Rachel's story. She sensed disbelief and then rage when she talked about Nora Manger's murder and their own near-death escape. Although Rachel wanted to voice her suspicions of the NASA administrator's involvement, she knew Pickering well enough not to point fingers without evidence. She gave Pickering the story as cold, hard facts. When she was finished, Pickering didn't respond for several seconds. "Miss Sexton," he finally said, "all of you." He moved his gaze to each of them. "If what you're saying is true, and I cannot imagine why three of you would lie about this, you were all very lucky to be alive." They all nodded in silence. The president had called in four civilian scientists, and two of them were now dead. Pickering heaved a disconsolate sigh, as if he had no idea what to say next. The events clearly made a little sense. "Is there any way," Pickering asked, "that this insertion shaft you're seeing in that GPR printout is a natural phenomenon?" Rachel shook her head. "It's too perfect." She unfolded the soggy GPR printout and held it up in front of the camera. "Flawless." Pickering studied the image, scowling in agreement. "Don't let that out of your hands." "I called Marjorie Tench to warn her to stop the president," Rachel said, "but she shut me down."
"I know, she told me."
Rachel looked up, stunned.
"Marjorie Tench called you?"
That was fast.
"Just now. She's very concerned. She feels you are attempting some kind of stunt to discredit the president and NASA, perhaps to help your father."
Rachel stood up. She waved the GPR printout and motioned to her two companions.
"We were almost killed. Does this look like some kind of stunt? And why would I..."
Pickering held up his hands.
"Easy. What Miss Tench failed to tell me was that there were three of you." Rachel couldn't recall if Tench had even given her time to mention Corky and Tolland. "Nor did she tell me you had physical evidence," Pickering said. "I was skeptical of her claims before I spoke to you, and now I am convinced she's mistaken." "I do not doubt your claims. The question at this point is what it all means."
There was a long silence. William Pickering rarely looked confused, but he shook his head, seeming lost.
"Let's assume for the moment that someone did insert this meteorite beneath the ice. That begs the obvious issue of why. If NASA has a meteorite with fossils in it, why would they, or anyone else for that matter, care where it is found?"
"It appears," Rachel said, "that the insertion was performed such that pods would make the discovery, and the meteorite would appear to be a fragment from a known impact."
"The Ingersoll Fall," Corky prompted. "But of what value is the meteorite's association with a known impact?" Pickering demanded, sounding almost mad. "Aren't these fossils an astounding discovery? Anywhere and any time, no matter what meteoritic event they are associated with."
All three nodded. Pickering hesitated, looking displeased.
"Unless, of course..."
Rachel saw the wheels turning behind the director's eyes. He had found the simplest explanation for placing the meteorite concurrent with the Jungersol strata, but the simplest explanation was also the most troubling.
"Unless," Pickering continued, "the careful placement was intended to lend credibility to totally false data."
He sighed, turning to Corky.
"Dr. Marlinson, what is the possibility that this meteorite is a counterfeit?"
"Counterfeit, sir?"
"Yes, a fake. Manufactured." "A fake meteorite?"
Corky gave an awkward laugh.
"Utterly impossible. That meteorite was examined by professionals, myself included. Chemical scans, spectrograph, rubidium-strontium dating. It is unlike any kind of rock ever seen on Earth. The meteorite is authentic. Any astrogeologist would agree."
Pickering seemed to consider this a long time, gently stroking his tie.
"And yet, taking into account the amount NASA has to gain from this discovery right now,
the apparent signs of tampering with evidence, and your being attacked, the first and only logical conclusion I can draw is that this meteorite is a well-executed fraud.
Impossible!
Corky sounded angry now. With all respect, sir, meteorites are not some Hollywood special effect that can be conjured up in a lab to fool a bunch of unsuspecting astrophysicists. They are chemically complex objects with unique crystalline structures and element ratios.
I'm not challenging you, Dr. Marlinson. I am simply following a logical chain of analysis. Considering someone wanted to kill you to keep you from revealing it was inserted under the ice, I'm inclined to entertain all kinds of wild scenarios here. What specifically makes you certain this rock is indeed a meteorite?
Specifically? Corky's voice cracked in the headphones. A flawless fusion crust. The presence of chondrules. A nickel ratio unlike anything ever found on Earth. If you're suggesting that someone tricked us by manufacturing this rock in a lab, then all I can say is that the lab was about 190 million years old.
Corky dug in his pocket and pulled out a stone shaped like a CD. He held it in front of the camera.
We chemically dated samples like this with numerous methods. Rubidium-strontium dating is not something you can fake.
Pickering looked surprised. You have a sample? Corky shrugged.
NASA has dozens of them floating around.
You mean to tell me, Pickering said, looking at Rachel now, that NASA discovered a meteorite they think contains life, and they're letting people walk off with samples?
The point, Corky said, is that the sample in my hand is genuine.
He held the rock close to the camera.
You could give this to any petrologist or geologist or astronomer on Earth. They would run tests, and they would tell you two things. One, it is 190 million years old. And two, it is chemically dissimilar from the kind of rock we have here on Earth.
Pickering leaned forward, studying the fossil embedded in the rock. He seemed momentarily transfixed. Finally, he sighed. I'm not a scientist. All I can say is that if that meteorite is genuine, which it appears it is, I would like to know why NASA didn't present it to the world at face value. Why has someone carefully placed it under the ice, as if to persuade us of its authenticity? At that moment, inside the White House, a security officer was dialing Marjorie Tench. The senior advisor answered on the first ring.
Yeah.
Miss Tench, the officer said, I have the information you requested earlier. The radio phone call that Rachel Sexton placed to you earlier this evening, we have the trace.
Tell me.
Secret Service Ops says the signal originated aboard the naval submarine USS Charlotte.
What?
They don't have coordinates, ma'am, but they're certain of the vessel code.
Oh, for Christ's sake.
Tench slammed down the receiver without another word. Chapter 72. The muted acoustics of the Charlotte's dead room were starting to make Rachel feel mildly nauseated. On screen, William Pickering's troubled gaze moved now to Michael Tolland.
You're quiet, Mr. Tolland.
Tolland glanced up like a student who had been called on unexpectedly.
Sir?
You just gave quite a convincing documentary on television, Pickering said. What's your take on the media right now?
Well, sir, Tolland said, his discomfort obvious, I have to agree with Dr. Marlinson. I believe the fossils and meteorite are authentic. I'm fairly well versed in dating techniques, and the age of that stone was confirmed by multiple tests. The nickel content as well. These data cannot be forged.
There exists no doubt the rock formed 190 million years ago, exhibits non-terrestrial nickel ratios, and contains dozens of confirmed fossils whose formation is also dated at 190 million years. I can think of no other possible explanation than that NASA has found an authentic meteorite.
Pickering fell silent now. His expression was one of quandary, a look Rachel had never before seen on William Pickering.
What should we do, sir? Rachel asked. Obviously, we need to alert the President there are problems with the data.
Pickering frowned.
Let's hope the president doesn't already know.
Rachel felt a knot rise in her throat. Pickering's implication was clear. President Herney could be involved. Rachel strongly doubted it, and yet both the president and NASA had plenty to gain here.
Unfortunately, Pickering said, with the exception of this GPR printout revealing an insertion shaft, all of the scientific data points to a credible NASA discovery.
He paused, dire.
And this issue of your being attacked,
he looked up at Rachel.
You mentioned special ops?
Yes, sir. She told him again about the improvised munitions and tactics. Pickering looked more and more unhappy by the moment. Rachel sensed her boss was contemplating the number of people who might have access to a small military kill force. Certainly the president had access. Probably Marjorie Tench, too, as senior advisor. Quite possibly NASA Administrator Lawrence Eckstrom, with his ties to the Pentagon. Unfortunately, as Rachel considered the myriad of possibilities, she realized the controlling force behind the attack could have been almost anyone with high-level political clout and the right connections.
I could phone the president right now, Pickering said, but I don't think that's wise, at least until we know who's involved. My ability to protect you becomes limited once we involve the White House. In addition, I'm not sure what I would tell him. If the meteorite is real, which you all feel it is, then your allegation of an insertion shaft and attack doesn't make sense. The president would have every right to question the validity of my claim.
He paused as if to calculate the options.
Regardless, whatever the truth is or who the players are, some very powerful people will take hits if this information goes public. I suggest we get you to safety right away before we start rocking any boats.
Get us to safety? The comment surprised Rachel. I think we're fairly safe on a nuclear submarine, sir. Pickering looked skeptical.
Your presence on that submarine won't stay secret long. I'm pulling you out immediately. Frankly, I'll feel better when the three of you are sitting in my office.
Chapter 73. Senator Sexton huddled alone on his couch, feeling like a refugee. His Westbrook Place apartment, that had only an hour ago been filled with new friends and supporters, now looked forsaken, scattered with the rubble of snifters and business cards, abandoned by men who had quite literally dashed out the door. Now Sexton crouched in solitude before his television, wanting more than anything to turn it off, and yet being unable to pull himself from the endless media analyses. This was Washington, and it didn't take long for the analysts to rush through their pseudo-scientific and philosophical hyperbole and lock in on the ugly stuff, the politics. Like torture masters rubbing acid in Sexton's wounds, the newscasters were stating and restating the obvious.
Hours ago, Sexton's campaign was soaring, one analyst said. Now, with NASA's discovery, the senator's campaign has crashed back to Earth.
Sexton winced, reaching for the Courvoisier and taking a hit right out of the bottle. Tonight, he knew, would be the longest and loneliest night of his life. He despised Marjorie Tench for setting him up. He despised Gabrielle Ashe for ever mentioning NASA in the first place. He despised the president for being so goddamn lucky. And he despised the world for laughing at him.
Obviously, this is devastating for the senator, the analyst was saying. The president and NASA have claimed an incalculable triumph with this discovery. News like this would revitalize the president's campaign, regardless of Sexton's position on NASA. But with Sexton's admission today that he would go so far as to abolish NASA funding outright if need be, well, this presidential announcement is a 1-2 punch from which the senator will not recover.
I was tricked, Sexton said. The White House fucking set me up.
The analyst was smiling now.
All of the credibility NASA has lost with Americans recently has just been restored in spades. There's a real feeling of national pride out there on the streets right now. As there should be. They love Zach Herney, and they were losing faith. You got to admit, the president was lying down and took some pretty big hits recently, but he's come out of it smelling like a rose.
Sexton thought of the CNN debate that afternoon and hung his head, thinking he might be sick to his stomach. All of the NASA inertia he had so carefully built up over the last months had not only come to a screeching halt, but it had become an anchor around his neck. He looked like a fool. He'd been brazenly played by the White House. He was already dreading all the cartoons in tomorrow's paper. His name would be the punchline to every joke in the country. Obviously, there would be no more quiet SFF campaign funding. Everything had changed. All the men who had been in his apartment had just seen their dreams go down the toilet. The privatization of space had just struck a brick wall. Taking another hit of cognac, the senator stood up and walked unevenly to his desk. He gazed down at the unhooked phone receiver. Knowing it was an act of masochistic self-flagellation, he slowly replaced the phone receiver in its cradle and began counting the seconds. One, two, the phone rang. He let the machine pick up. "Senator Sexton, Judy Oliver from CNN. I'd like to give you an opportunity to react to the NASA discovery this evening. Please call me." She hung up. Sexton started counting again. One. The phone started ringing. He ignored it, letting the machine get it. Another reporter. Holding his bottle of Courvoisier, Sexton wandered toward the sliding door of his balcony. He pulled it aside and stepped out into the cool air. Leaning against the railing, he gazed out across town to the illuminated facade of the White House in the distance. The lights seemed to twinkle gleefully in the wind. "Bastards," he thought. "For centuries we've been looking for proof of life in the heavens. Now we find it in the same fucking year as my election? This wasn't propitious. This was goddamn clairvoyant." Every apartment window for as far as Sexton could see had a television on. Sexton wondered where Gabrielle Ash was tonight. This was all her fault. She'd fed him NASA failure after NASA failure. He raised the bottle to take another swig. "God damn, Gabrielle. She's the reason I'm in this so deep." Across town, standing amid the chaos of the ABC production room, Gabrielle Ash felt numb. The president's announcement had come out of left field, leaving her suspended in a semi-catatonic haze. She stood lock-kneed in the center of the production room floor, staring up at one of the television monitors, while pandemonium raged around her. The initial seconds of the announcement had brought dead silence to the newsroom floor. It had lasted only moments before the place erupted into a deafening carnival of scrambling reporters. These people were professionals. They had no time for personal reflection. There would be time for that after the work was done. At the moment, the world wanted to know more, and ABC had to provide it. This story had everything: science, history, political drama, an emotional mother load. Nobody in the media was sleeping tonight. "Gabs," Yolanda's voice was sympathetic, "let's get you back into my office before someone realizes who you are and starts grilling you on what this means for Sexton's campaign." Gabrielle felt herself guided through a haze into Yolanda's glass-walled office. Yolanda sat her down and handed her a glass of water. She tried to force a smile. "Look on the bright side, Gabs. Your candidate's campaign is fucked, but at least you're not." "Thanks. Terrific." Yolanda's tone turned serious. "Gabrielle, I know you feel like shit. Your candidate just got hit by a Mack truck, and if you ask me, he's not getting up. At least not in time to turn this thing around. But at least nobody's splashing your picture all over the television. Seriously, this is good news. Herney won't need a sex scandal now. He's looking far too presidential right now to talk sex." It seemed a small consolation to Gabrielle. "As for Tench's allegations of Sexton's illegal campaign finance," Yolanda shook her head, "I have my doubts. Granted, Herney is serious about no negative campaigning, and granted, a bribery investigation would be bad for the country. But is Herney really so patriotic that he would forego a chance to crush his opposition simply to protect national morale?
My guess is Tench stretched the truth about Sexton's finances in an effort to scare. She gambled, hoping you'd jump ship and give the president a free sex scandal. And you've got to admit, Gabs, tonight would have been a hell of a night for Sexton's morals to come into question.
Gabriel nodded vaguely. A sex scandal would have been a 1-2 punch from which Sexton's career would never have recovered. Ever.
You outlasted her, Gabs. Marjorie Tench went fishing, but you didn't bite. You're home free.
There'll be other elections.
Gabriel nodded vaguely, unsure what to believe anymore. You got to admit, Yolanda said, the White House played Sexton brilliantly. Luring him down the NASA path, getting him to commit, coaxing him to put all his eggs in the NASA basket.
Totally my fault, Gabriel thought.
And this announcement we just watched, my God, it was genius. The importance of the discovery entirely aside, the production values were brilliant. Live feeds from the Arctic? A Michael Tollin documentary? Good God. How can you compete? Zach Herney nailed it tonight. There's a reason the guy is president.
And will be for another 4 years.
I gotta get back to work, Gabs, Yolanda said. You sit right there as long as you want. Get your feet under you.
Yolanda headed out the door.
Han, I'll check back in a few minutes.
Alone now, Gabrielle sipped her water, but it tasted foul. Everything did. It's all my fault, she thought, trying to ease her conscience by reminding herself of all the glum NASA press conferences of the past year. The space station setbacks, the postponement of the X-33, all the failed Mars probes, continuous budget bailouts. Gabrielle wondered what she could have done differently.
Nothing, she told herself. You did everything right.
It had simply backfired. Chapter 74. The thundering Navy Seahawk chopper had been scrambled under a covert operation status out of Thule Air Force Base in northern Greenland. It stayed low, out of radar range, as it shot through the gale winds across 70 miles of open sea. Then, executing the bizarre orders they had been given, the pilots fought the wind and brought the craft to a hover above a preordained set of coordinates on the empty ocean.
"Where's the rendezvous?"
the co-pilot yelled, confused. They had been told to bring a chopper with a rescue winch, so he anticipated a search-and-retrieve operation.
"You sure these are the right coordinates?"
He scanned the choppy seas with a searchlight, but there was nothing below them except...
"Holy shit!"
The pilot pulled back on the stick, jolting upward. The black mountain of steel rose before them out of the waves without warning. A gargantuan, unmarked submarine blew its ballast and rose on a cloud of bubbles. The pilots exchanged uneasy laughs.
"Guess that's them."
As ordered, the transaction proceeded under complete radio silence. The double-wide portal on the peak of the sail opened, and a seaman flashed them signals with a strobe light. The chopper then moved over the sub and dropped a 3-man rescue harness, essentially 3 rubberized loops on a retractable cable. Within 60 seconds, the 3 unknown danglers were swinging beneath the chopper, ascending slowly against the downdraft of the rotors. When the co-pilot hauled them aboard, 2 men and a woman, the pilot flashed the sub the all clear. Within seconds, the enormous vessel disappeared beneath the windswept sea, leaving no trace it had ever been there. With the passengers safely aboard, the chopper pilot faced front, dipped the nose of the chopper, and accelerated south to complete his mission. The storm was closing fast, and these 3 strangers were to be brought safely back to Thule Air Force Base for further jet transport. Where they were headed, the pilot had no idea. All he knew was that his orders had been from high up, and he was transporting very precious cargo. Chapter 75. When the Milne storm finally exploded, unleashing its full force on the NASA habitosphere, the dome shuddered as if ready to lift off the ice and launch out to sea. The steel stabilizing cables pulled taut against their stakes, vibrating like huge guitar strings and letting out a doleful drone. The generators outside stuttered, causing the lights to flicker, threatening to plunge the huge room into total blackness.
NASA Administrator Lawrence Ekstrom strode across the interior of the dome. He wished he were getting the hell out of here tonight, but that was not to be. He would remain another day, giving additional on-site press conferences in the morning and overseeing preparations to transport the meteorite back to Washington. He wanted nothing more at the moment than to get some sleep. The day's unexpected problems had taken a lot out of him. Ekstrom's thoughts turned again to Whaley Ming, Rachel Sexton, Nora Manger, Michael Tolland, and Corky Marlinson. Some of the NASA staff had begun noticing the civilians were missing.
"Relax," Ekstrom told himself. "Everything is under control."
He breathed deeply, reminding himself that everyone on the planet was excited about NASA and space right now. Extraterrestrial life hadn't been this exciting a topic since the famous Roswell incident back in 1947, the alleged crash of an alien spaceship in Roswell, New Mexico, which was now the shrine to millions of UFO conspiracy theorists even today. During Ekstrom's years working at the Pentagon, he had learned that the Roswell incident had been nothing more than a military accident during a classified operation called Project Mogul, the flight test of a spy balloon being designed to listen in on Russian atomic tests. The prototype, while being tested, had drifted off course and crashed in the New Mexico desert. Unfortunately, a civilian found the wreckage before the military did. Unsuspecting rancher William Brazel had stumbled across a debris field of radical synthesized neoprene and lightweight metals unlike anything he'd ever seen, and he immediately called in the sheriff. Newspapers carried the story of the bizarre wreckage, and public interest grew fast. Fueled by the military's denial that the wreckage was theirs, reporters launched investigations, and the covert status of Project Mogul came into serious jeopardy. Just as it seemed the sensitive issue of a spy balloon was about to be revealed, something wonderful happened. The media drew an unexpected conclusion. They decided the scraps of futuristic substance could only have come from an extraterrestrial source, creatures more scientifically advanced than humans. The military's denial of the incident obviously had to be one thing only, a cover-up of contact with aliens. Although baffled by this new hypothesis, the Air Force was not about to look a gift horse in the mouth. They grabbed the alien story and ran with it. The world's suspicions that aliens were visiting New Mexico was far less a threat to national security than that of the Russians catching wind of Project Mogul. To fuel the alien cover story, the intelligence community shrouded the Roswell incident in secrecy and began orchestrating security leaks, quiet murmurings of alien contacts, recovered spaceships, and even a mysterious Hangar 18 at Dayton's Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, where the government was keeping alien bodies on ice. The world bought the story, and Roswell fever swept the globe. From that moment on, whenever a civilian mistakenly spotted an advanced U.S. military aircraft, the intelligence community simply dusted off the old conspiracy. "That's not an aircraft. That's an alien spaceship." Ekstrom was amazed to think this simple deception was still working today. Every time the media reported a sudden flurry of UFO sightings, Ekstrom had to laugh. Chances were some lucky civilian had caught a glimpse of one of the NRO's 57 fast-moving unmanned reconnaissance aircraft known as Global Hawks, oblong, remote-controlled aircraft that looked like nothing else in the sky. Ekstrom found it pathetic that countless tourists still made pilgrimages to the New Mexico desert to scan the night skies with their video cameras. Occasionally one got lucky and captured hard evidence of a UFO. Bright lights flitting around the sky with more maneuverability and speed than any aircraft humans had ever built. What these people failed to realize, of course, was that there existed a 12-year lag between what the government could build and what the public knew about. These UFO gazers were simply catching a glimpse of the next generation of U.S. aircraft being developed out at Area 51, many of which were the brainstorms of NASA engineers.
Of course, intelligence officials never corrected the misconception. It was obviously preferable that the world read about another UFO sighting than to have people learn the U.S. military's true flight capabilities. But everything has changed now, Ekstrom thought. In a few hours, the extraterrestrial myth would become a confirmed reality. Forever.
Administrator?
A NASA technician hurried across the ice behind him.
You have an emergency secure call in the PSC.
Ekstrom sighed, turning. What the hell could it be now? He headed for the communications trailer. The technician hurried along beside him.
The guys manning the radar in the PSC were curious, sir.
Yeah? Ekstrom's thoughts were still far away. The fat body sub stationed off the coast here. We were wondering why you didn't mention it to us. Ekstrom glanced up.
I'm sorry?
The submarine, sir. You could have at least told the guys on radar. Additional seaboard security is understandable, but it took our radar team off guard.
Ekstrom stopped short. What submarine?
The technician stopped now, too, clearly not expecting the administrator's surprise.
She's not part of our operation?
No. Where is it? The technician swallowed hard.
About 3 miles out? We caught her on radar by chance. Only surfaced for a couple of minutes. Pretty big blip. Had to be a fat body. We figured you'd ask the Navy to stand watch over this op without telling any of us.
Ekstrom stared.
I most certainly did not.
Now the technician's voice wavered.
Well, sir, then, I guess I should inform you that a sub just rendezvoused with an aircraft right off the coast here. Looked like a personnel change. Actually, we were all pretty impressed anyone would attempt a wet, dry vertical in this kind of wind.
Ekstrom felt his muscles stiffen. What the hell is a submarine doing directly off the coast of Ellesmere Island without my knowledge?
Did you see what direction the aircraft flew after rendezvous?
Back toward Thule Air Force Base, for connecting transport to the mainland, I assume.
Ekstrom said nothing the rest of the way to the PSC. When he entered the cramped darkness, the hoarse voice on the line had a familiar rasp.
We've got a problem, Tench said, coughing as she spoke. It's about Rachel Sexton.
Chapter 76. Senator Sexton wasn't sure how long he had been staring into space when he heard the pounding. When he realized the throbbing in his ears was not from the alcohol, but rather from someone at his apartment door, he got up from the couch, stowed the bottle of Courvoisier, and made his way to the foyer.
"Who is it?"
Sexton yelled, in no mood for visitors. His bodyguard's voice called in with the identity of Sexton's unexpected guest. Sexton sobered instantly.
That was fast.
Sexton had hoped not to have this conversation until morning. Taking a deep breath and straightening his hair, Sexton opened the door. The face before him was all too familiar. Tough and leathery, despite the man's 70-something years. Sexton had met with him only this morning in the white Ford Windstar minivan in a hotel parking garage.
Was it only this morning? Sexton wondered. God, how things had changed since then.
May I come in? The dark-haired man asked.
Sexton stepped aside, allowing the head of the Space Frontier Foundation to pass.
Did the meeting go well?
The man asked as Sexton closed the door.
Did it go well? Sexton wondered if the man lived in a cocoon.
Things were terrific until the president came on television.
The old man nodded, looking displeased.
Yes, an incredible victory. It will hurt our cause greatly.
Hurt our cause? Here was an optimist.
With NASA's triumph tonight, this guy would be dead and buried before the Space Frontier Foundation attained their goals of privatization.
For years I have suspected proof was forthcoming, the old man said. I didn't know how or when, but sooner or later we had to know for sure.
Sexton was stunned.
You're not surprised?
The mathematics of the cosmos virtually requires other life forms, the man said, moving towards Sexton's den.
I am not surprised that this discovery has been made. Intellectually, I'm thrilled. Spiritually, I am in awe. Politically, I am deeply disturbed. The timing could not be worse. Sexton wondered why the man had come. It sure as hell wasn't to cheer him up. As you know, the man said, SFF member companies have spent millions trying to open the frontier of space to private citizens. Recently, much of that money has gone to your campaign. Sexton felt suddenly defensive. I had no control over tonight's fiasco. The White House baited me to attack NASA. Yes, the president played the game well. And yet, all may not be lost. There was an odd glint of hope in the old man's eyes. He's senile, Sexton decided. All was definitely lost. Every station on television right now was talking about the destruction of the Sexton campaign. The old man showed himself into the den, sat on the couch, and fixed his tired eyes on the senator. Do you recall, the man said, the problems NASA initially had with the anomaly software on board the pod satellite? Sexton couldn't imagine where this was headed. What the hell difference does that make now? Pods found a goddamn meteorite with fossils. If you remember, the man said, the onboard software didn't function properly at first. You made a big deal of it in the press. As I should have, Sexton said, sitting down opposite the man. It was another NASA failure. The man nodded. I agree. But shortly after that, NASA held a press conference announcing they had come up with a workaround, some sort of patch for the software. Sexton hadn't actually seen the press conference, but he'd heard it was short, flat, and hardly newsworthy. The pod's project leader giving a dull technical description of how NASA had overcome a minor glitch in pod's anomaly detection software and gotten everything up and running. I've been watching pods with interest ever since it failed, the man said. He produced a video cassette and walked to Sexton's television, putting the video in the VCR. This should interest you. The video began to play. It showed the NASA press room at headquarters in Washington. A well-dressed man was taking the podium and greeting the audience. The subtitle beneath the podium read, Chris Harper, Section Manager, Polar Orbiting Density Scanner Satellite, PODS. Chris Harper was tall, refined, and spoke with the quiet dignity of a European-American who still clung proudly to his roots. His accent was erudite and polished. He was addressing the press conference with confidence, giving them some bad news about PODS. Although the PODS satellite is in orbit and functioning well, we have a minor setback with the onboard computers. A minor programming error for which I take full responsibility. Specifically, the FIR filter has a faulty voxel index, which means the pod's anomaly detection software is not functioning properly. We are working on a fix. The crowd sighed, apparently accustomed to NASA letdowns. What does that mean for the current effectiveness of the satellite? Someone asked. Harper took it like a pro, confident and matter-of-fact. Imagine a perfect set of eyes without a functioning brain. Essentially, the pod satellite is seeing 20/20, but it has no idea what it's looking at. The purpose of the pod's mission is to look for melt pockets in the polar ice cap. But without the computer to analyze the density data pods receives from its scanners, pods cannot discern where the points of interest are. We should have the situation remedied after the next shuttle mission can make an adjustment to the onboard computer. A groan of disappointment rose in the room. The old man glanced over at Sexton. He presents bad news pretty well, doesn't he? He's from NASA, Sexton grumbled. That's what they do. The VCR tape went blank for an instant and then switched to another NASA press conference. This second press conference, the old man said to Sexton, was given only a few weeks ago. Quite late at night, few people saw it. This time, Dr. Harper is announcing good news. The footage launched. This time, Chris Harper looked disheveled and uneasy.
I am pleased to announce, Harper said, sounding anything but pleased, that NASA has found a workaround for the pod's satellite software problem. He fumbled through an explanation of the workaround, something about redirecting the raw data from pods and sending it through computers here on Earth, rather than relying on the onboard pod's computer. Everyone seemed impressed. It all sounded quite feasible and exciting. When Harper was done, the room gave him an enthusiastic round of applause. "So we can expect data soon?" someone in the audience asked. Harper nodded, sweating. A couple of weeks. More applause. Hands shot up around the room. "That's all I have for you now," Harper said, looking ill as he packed up his papers. "Pods is up and running. We'll have data soon." He practically ran off the stage. Sexton scowled. He had to admit, this was odd. Why did Chris Harper look so comfortable giving bad news and so uncomfortable giving good news? It should have been in reverse. Sexton hadn't actually seen this press conference when it aired, although he'd read about the software fix. The fix at the time seemed an inconsequential NASA salvage. The public perception remained unimpressed. Pods was just another NASA project that had malfunctioned and was being awkwardly patched together with a less-than-ideal solution. The old man turned off the television. "NASA claimed Dr. Harper was not feeling well that night." He paused. "I happen to think Harper was lying." "Lying?" Sexton stared, his fuzzy thoughts unable to piece together any logical rationale for why Harper would have lied about the software. Still, Sexton had told enough lies in his life to recognize a poor liar when he saw one. He had to admit, Dr. Harper sure looked suspicious. "Perhaps you don't realize," the old man said, "this little announcement you just heard Chris Harper give is the single most important press conference in NASA history." He paused. "That convenient software fix he just described is what allowed Pods to find the meteorite." Sexton puzzled. "And you think he was lying about it?" "But if Harper was lying and the Pods software isn't really working, then how the hell did NASA find the meteorite?" The old man smiled. "Exactly." Chapter 77. The U.S. military's fleet of repo aircraft, repossessed during drug trade arrests, consisted of over a dozen private jets, including three reconditioned G-4s used for transporting military VIPs. A half hour ago, one of those G-4s had lifted off the Thule runway, fought its way above the storm, and was now pounding southward into the Canadian night en route to Washington. On board, Rachel Sexton, Michael Tolland, and Corky Marlinson had the 8-seat cabin to themselves, looking like some kind of disheveled sports team in their matching blue USS Charlotte jumpsuits and caps. Despite the roar of the Grumman engines, Corky Marlinson was asleep in the rear. Tolland sat near the front, looking exhausted as he gazed out the window at the sea. Rachel was beside him, knowing she couldn't sleep even if she'd been sedated. Her mind churned through the mystery of the meteorite, and, most recently, the dead-room conversation with Pickering. Before signing off, Pickering had given Rachel two additional pieces of disturbing information. First, Marjorie Tench claimed to possess a video recording of Rachel's private deposition to the White House staff. Tench was now threatening to use the video as evidence if Rachel tried to go back on her confirmation of the meteorite data. The news was particularly unsettling because Rachel had specifically told Zach Herney that her remarks to the staff were for in-house use only. Apparently, Zach Herney had ignored that request. The second bit of troubling news dealt with a CNN debate her father had attended earlier in the afternoon. Apparently, Marjorie Tench had made a rare appearance and deftly baited Rachel's father into crystallizing his position against NASA. More specifically, Tench had cajoled him into crudely proclaiming his skepticism that extraterrestrial life would ever be found. Eat his hat?
That's what Pickering said her father had offered to do if NASA ever found extraterrestrial life. Rachel wondered how Tench had managed to coax out that propitious little soundbite. Clearly the White House had been setting the stage carefully, ruthlessly lining up all the dominoes, preparing for the big Sexton collapse. The president and Marjorie Tench, like some sort of political tag team wrestling duo, had maneuvered for the kill. While the president remained dignified outside the ring, Tench had moved in, circling, cunningly lining up the senator for the presidential body slam. The president had told Rachel he'd asked NASA to delay announcing the discovery in order to provide time to confirm the accuracy of the data. Rachel now realized there were other advantages to waiting. The extra time had given the White House time to dole out the rope with which the senator would hang himself. Rachel felt no sympathy for her father, and yet she now realized that beneath the warm and fuzzy exterior of President Zach Herney, a shrewd shark lurked. You didn't become the most powerful man in the world without a killer instinct. The question now was whether this shark was an innocent bystander or a player. Rachel stood, stretching her legs. As she paced the aisle of the plane, she felt frustrated that the pieces to this puzzle seemed so contradictory. Pickering, with his trademark chaste logic, had concluded the meteorite must be fake. Corky and Tolland, with scientific assurance, insisted the meteorite was authentic. Rachel only knew what she had seen, a charred, fossilized rock being pulled from the ice. Now, as she passed beside Corky, she gazed down at the astrophysicist, battered from his ordeal on the ice. The swelling on his cheek was going down now, and the stitches looked good. He was asleep, snoring, his pudgy hands clutching the disc-shaped meteorite sample like some kind of security blanket. Rachel reached down and gently slipped the meteorite sample away from him. She held it up, studying the fossils again. "Remove all assumptions," she told herself, forcing herself to reorganize her thoughts. "Re-establish the chain of substantiation." It was an old NRO trick. Rebuilding a proof from scratch was a process known as null start, something all data analysts practiced when the pieces didn't quite fit. Reassemble the proof. She began pacing again. Does this stone represent proof of extraterrestrial life? Proof, she knew, was a conclusion built on a pyramid of facts, a broad base of accepted information on which more specific assertions were made. Remove all the base assumptions. Start again. What do we have? A rock. She pondered that for a moment. A rock. A rock with fossilized creatures. Walking back toward the front of the plane, she took her seat beside Michael Tolland. Mike, let's play a game. Tolland turned from the window, looking distant, apparently deep in his own thoughts.
A game?
She handed him the meteorite sample. Let's pretend you're seeing this fossilized rock for the first time. I've told you nothing about where it came from or how it was found. What would you tell me it is? Tolland heaved a disconsolate sigh.
Funny you should ask. I just had the strangest thought.
Hundreds of miles behind Rachel and Tolland, a strange-looking aircraft stayed low as it tore south above a deserted ocean. On board, the Delta Force was silent. They had been pulled out of locations in a hurry, but never like this. Their controller was furious. Earlier, Delta One had informed the controller that unexpected events on the ice shelf had left his team with no option but to exercise force. Force that had included killing four civilians, including Rachel Sexton and Michael Tolland. The controller reacted with shock. Killing, although an authorized last resort, obviously never had been part of the controller's plan. Later, the controller's displeasure over the killings turned to outright rage when he learned the assassinations had not gone as planned.
"Your team failed,"
the controller seethed, the androgynous tone hardly masking the person's rage.
"Three of your four targets are still alive."
Impossible, Delta One had thought. But we witnessed. They made contact with a submarine and are now en route to Washington.
What?
The controller's tone turned lethal.